Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Hard Truth with myself, David Vance, and Alana Mercer. Hi, Alana.
Hi, David. Hi, all.
Good to see you, Alana. Another week has gone by. So much happens and so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it. But just before we bring on our special guest, again, a big word of thanks, I think, to all our followers, especially over on Rumble there, where we do really appreciate their all their views of the content we're putting out. Don't we?
Absolutely. Am I supposed to agree? It's implicit, David.
You can disagree.
I'm very grateful for all the followers, especially on Rumble. And we're happy to patronize Rumble, and we're happy that they're having us. Because we're in the doghouse on YouTube periodically.
Well, of course, I don't know if you, again, just before we bring on our special guest, I don't know if you saw the news, but Rumble has announced it's going to be partnering with Trump for his platform whenever it arrives on in February. So I think it's all good stuff. It's all about free speech and about people being able to have these candid conversations, Alana, like we do every week, you know. And it's shameful that Taliban Tube, as you call them, which is a great title, and as I can't even start to talk about Twitter, it gets me too emotional because I've been banned, as you know, and Facebook, all of these big Silicon Valley, Soy Valley platforms, we need alternatives to them to be able to talk about the things that matter. So that being said, folks, we've got a special treat in store for you tonight. We've got a special guest, and can we bring our special guest into the studio, please? Hello, Anne Wilson-Smith. Hi, Anne. How are you?
Great. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. Thanks very much for taking some time out to be with Alana and myself. Now, I know this is the first time you've been on Hard Truth, but you've been telling some hard truths of your own in your recently published book, which I think we've got a picture of. We can bring it up on screen, but I think it's actually physically present as well in Alana. Charlottesville Untold, Inside, Unite the Right, by Anne Wilson-Smith. Available Amazon, available on the website, available all good bookstores, I suppose. I should say, Anne, really, shouldn't I? But I'm never sure with censorship how that works. It's also available in Alana Mercer's Fair Hands. I think Alana's got a copy there, as she can confirm. So, yes. So anyway, you're very welcome on the stream, Anne. Thanks very
much. Thank you so much.
And as we were chatting just earlier before we came on air, you know, I think in the light of events that we saw in Washington and D.C. back in January the 6th, and in recent times, we now begin to have to question lots of things. Are they what they appear to be? Which I guess brings us nicely into your book. So maybe, Alana, would you like to come in this one?
And yes, Anne's book is absolutely swirling with personal stories, all align perfectly to support a very strong narrative. It is also dense with data, and in particular, Anne, the HEAFY report, which is really the investigation into the big Soviet lie that we are confronting here. So what really hit me, I think I was wrestling with all these, and we had a few emails, I was wrestling with all these this confluence of personal stories and the data and the HEAFY report. When it hit me, when the big lie hit me, was when the procession was making its way from Lee Park, from the, to Lee Park, from the
parking garage.
Exactly, yeah. From the parking garages, mm-hmm. The very mixed, variegated, diverse people that came to Unite the Right, unlike what the media is telling us. And these people, many of them old and fragile and were confronted with the most horrific, feral mob, fulminating and frothing at the mouth. You speak about and you bring good evidence of condoms filled with cement, human waste tossed at these people, and they are just marching on. I think that's a really good place, because that's when it hit me. And you have, you describe the smug police standing back, smirking almost. That's when it hit me. The impetus of the book is the setup by the city and the state. Take us through that.
The rally was permitted. The permit was validated just a day or two before the rally. The city had wanted to move the rally to a location outside of downtown, and the organizers fought and were able to get this permit validated. Because it's a very left-wing city, there was a lot of resistance to the rally being there, public and the government. And what they did was, in essence, the police were so passive as to not protect the rally goers' right to assemble and speak. They basically stood down throughout the day, and all the scenes of violence that were viral all over the news and the internet in the subsequent days were the result of that police inaction. It's really a case of anarcho-tyranny is what happened.
What happened when they reached the place? They had a permit to speak at Lee Park, subsequently misnamed as Emancipation Park. We'll stick to Lee Park as a proud Southern historian. Yourself, and you come from a family of Southern historians, Clyde Wilson. Take us what happened when they were almost ambushed at this very narrow entry to the park.
There have been a lot of pictures of the people with shields, and they have been kind of maligned as being, you know, ready to fight. But actually, the people with shields were protecting the entrance in a way that the law enforcement was not. So the people, some of them were marching in a column. Some groups got together and marched down the street in a column. Other people were being dropped off, but with shuttles, and were a few blocks from the park and had to walk through a gauntlet to get there. And the people with shields were helping to deflect the projectiles and the things that were being thrown at the people that were trying to get into the park.
Tell us a little about, I'll see to my partner, David, soon. Just set the scene with some very interesting characters involved. Jason Kessler, Richard Spencer, if you could give us the scoop, the inside story. Who was it? Was it organized as the media? It seems very haphazard. People came together spontaneously. There was even someone from my country of birth, South Africa, inspired by the Trumpian Unite the Right. Very different people. Take us, speak a little to the characters. Mr. Kessler, who's suffering in the aftermath, and how Richard Spencer and some of the other characters fit into the whole very fascinating narrative you etch.
The concept was Unite the Right. There was supposed to be a wide array of people, and Jason Kessler wanted to get as many people as possible, and he had envisioned something that included a lot of MAGA, Trump-type supporters, mainstream conservatives, and as well as some of the more, I guess, alt-right-type figures, and as some of the more controversial figures joined on, some of the more mainstream people shied away and dropped out. So it ended up being a little bit more heavy on the extreme side than it was intended to be. But there was a lot of there wasn't really a lot of unity in Unite the Right. There was a lot of conflicts about who should be involved with speaking, about the logistical plans. People had different ideas. There were different groups that didn't always get along. So there was a lot of conflict behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that interests me, the fact that you're trying to unite something which by definition is quite diverse, isn't it, Anne? I mean, the fact is that unlike the left, we are not a homogenous blob that just instantly agrees with each other and everything. And that was manifest on the day, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There were, different groups of people that completely broke off from the planners and had their own plans about how to get in and out. And yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to say, just to touch on, you mentioned the passivity of the police. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, that was back back then. We saw the passivity of, again, how passive the police were last summer, summer 2020, when BLM decided to burn down Democrat cities, along with the approval of the Democrats, apparently. So I mean, I think Charlottesville was actually, it was an early warning. It was an early warning of what it was to happen and where we now are, where it appears that certain cities and certain groups can do what they want without any issues, any with impunity. But if other people do it, they're demonized, as has happened post-Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people I interviewed said that they just assumed that the police would do their job. It didn't even cross their mind. They assumed the police would keep the different groups apart, and prevent mm-hmm. the conflict. And looking yeah. back, they feel foolish and naive for trusting that. But at the time, I think that especially, and maybe with the exception of places like, you know, Berkeley or, the more extreme left cities, that people assumed the police would do their job. And you know, that. So this was kind of it was a beginning, I think, of a template of what they're doing. A lot of people mentioned the January 6th thing. And I think that there are some similarities there is that, you know, people breached the Capitol and, you know, you would assume that the law enforcement of a place like the White House would not allow that.
Yes. And this was a harbinger of things to come in the summer of love. When was it 2020? Yes. Just last year. Where we watched our cities sacked and the police stand down. We in Seattle here, we had a no-go zone. The police defected, but abandoned their officers and boarded them up. And then across the country, and we saw policemen dropping to the floor like yogis in front of their abusers and swearing allegiance to the cause of Black Lives Matter. So that was really, Charlottesville was a harbinger of things to come. But our side, when you say, I'm on the side of everybody's right to speak. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, what happened when the governor declared very opportunely and just as people were about to exercise their right to speak mm-hmm. at Lee Park, what did the governor do?
Well, they declared a state of emergency and they announced. Now, this is the part that most of the rally goers, it was about a half an hour before it was supposed to start. So most of the rally goers were in or very near the park, were ordered to disperse or be arrested. There was an intercom announcement, disperse, the rally's been declared an unlawful assembly or be arrested. So now you think this park is in the downtown area surrounded by a mob and the police have been passive all day. Now the rally goers are forced and at one point, the riot police started moving into the park with their shields, pushing people out. They pushed people into a group, an armed and hostile political mm-hmm. opponent group. And that's when a lot of the injuries occurred. That's when a lot of the viral photos of fighting took place.
Yeah, so actually the police were significantly, they carry culpability, don't they? Because had they not done that, then at least some of that would not have happened.
Right. The there are other ways that the park could have been evacuated.
But this was a setup, and this comes through clearly in your book, well into the book. Speak about the magnitude of the setup. I mean, what we have here now is literally nobody on the right of, I don't know, Liz Cheney and Adam Kritzinger will be allowed to assemble and speak certain truths they see fit to speak in accordance with our Bill of Rights.
Right. Well, that's true. If the police are allowed to not enforce, the right to assembly, that's what happens. And in this case, it's even worse than just not enforcing the right to assembly. They actually, when people were fighting, they prosecuted people that were involved in these conflicts unequally. The rally goers got much harsher punishment than the counter protesters in this case. So people are forced to defend themselves and then punished for the conflict.
Yes, speak to the aftermath, with which again is very similar to the January 6th aftermath, the legal avenues that the aggrieved Black Lives Matter took, and the heavy hitters that they hired to reverse, I'm not going to say the odious word, the cliche narrative, the storyline, to absolutely reverse history. Speak to that.
Are you talking about the civil suit, subsequent civil suit? There was a very large civil suit, and it just concluded with nationally renowned attorneys. The suit was funded by Hollywood and Silicon Valley. Millions of dollars poured into a lawsuit to hold the defendants liable for supposedly committing a conspiracy to commit racially motivated violence. They pulled out an old act from the Klan era to sue the rally organizers. And they spent 3 weeks basically going through all their old social media and pulling out, you know, unseemly things that were said, and, you know, and trying to hold them liable for millions and millions of dollars for the violence that occurred, which, you know, the Heathy report, which you mentioned earlier, the city commissioned this report. It was by an independent investigator, a former prosecutor. They very thorough report. It was hundreds of pages long, talked to, you know, interviewed lots of people, lots of video reviewed. And they basically concluded that the authorities were at fault, that they had stood down. The Heathy report was not allowed in as evidence. It was considered hearsay, I think, was not allowed in for this this civil trial. And the defendants were held liable for millions of dollars. And it may not be the financial settlement may not be as bad as it originally seems, but still the message is, if you try to hold a rally and things go wrong, you could be sued and your life ruined. So it's a chilling effect on rights to speech and assembly, which is and the plaintiff lawyers pretty much said that was their intention.
Yes. Sorry to go ahead.
I mean, I find that shocking that can happen in a court of law. It surprises me. I'm not sure that could happen in the UK, but the fact that the Heathy report couldn't be admitted as evidence. Mm-hmm. Stunning, amazing, Anne. I mean, how can that even be? How is that possible?
I think it was considered hearsay. I'm not really sure about that, but you know, it's
hearsay. But it was carried out. It was conducted by the local authorities. What wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't some guy in the middle of nowhere doing it. It was Hatchell, the local authority conducted the authorities carried it out. That's amazing stuff, that. Yeah. But as you're right, it also sends a message, I mean, which we saw on January 6th as well. Right. If you dare go up against the establishment, you will be smeared and demolished and financially pilloried. Yeah, sorry, Alana.
David, the legal, I'd be very interested, and I think you are right that British law would still be quite conservative compared to the radicalization of a man. And it's a point I bring up, Anne, in my own chronicle of you're chronicling the South, I chronicled South Africa. Mm-hmm. The indigenization of law based on Roman Dutch principles, became something completely different, you know, subsequent to democracy in 94. And I really draw parallels here. And something is happening to our law. And I think it's inconvenient. And Fox News will definitely be on the side of evil. But I would put these Me Too prosecutions in the same sort of debasement of the law, where due process doesn't matter. Independent reports and so on. And what do you think about that notion of degradation of our proud legal system?
Yeah, well, a lot of people consider it an abuse of the legal system. Describe the suit as a strategic lawsuit against public participation, you know, which is kind of really bad faith. They're basically, you know, using the law in a punitive way it wasn't intended. It's really not about the plaintiffs and their injuries. And you know, the headlines did say that they won millions of dollars against the defendants. It really was not, it seems that the jury didn't like either side in the case. And a lot of the compensatory damages were $1, $0.
Yes, and that's notorious. I think there are older movies about that, when juries, it's very theatrical, when juries award $1, they really are being contemptuous towards, you know, maybe both sides. I like to think about them being more contemptuous towards the Black Lives Matter side, but nevertheless, because what about the gentleman who tried to defend someone in the parking lot?
Well, that's one of the most misrepresented things, I think. We've all seen the viral photo of there was a Black man on the ground with several men with, you know, standing around him, and he raised hundreds of thousands of dollars online donations. But what most people don't know, if you look at the entire video leading up to that, was that he was instigated the fight. He hit someone over the head with a heavy flashlight and knocked them unconscious. And, you know, and people rushed in to respond to that. Now they may have overreacted, but still they were reacting to something he did. And that's never, I've never seen that mentioned in any mainstream coverage at all. Also, you may have seen the photo with the flamethrower. The man who was wielding the flamethrower towards the park was part of the entourage with the man who was on the ground, who, you know, in parking garage fight. So they had been roaming around all day. They were looking, you know, they were looking to interact and you know, cause trouble.
Yes, and look at CNN now is running a whole, we've seen their programming, White Power on Trial. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something, Anne. The left defines their own terms. Mm-hmm. You can't call a boy who wants to be a girl anything but what that person wants to be called. Mm-hmm. Why are we so left at white power, white supremacists, neo-Nazis? Why don't we better insist on our terms of debate, such as white nationalism, maybe white lives matter? In the case of Kessler, a rebound against a mayor who was explicitly anti-white, why can't we better insist on our terms of debate and not be interviewed? And this is a critique of Richard Spencer. Unless they call me a white nationalist, I will not speak to CNN. Why can't we be more insistent on our terms of debate?
I would assume it has to do with the fact that the mainstream media has a lot more left-wing control. I mean, I don't think we have that level of media control.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
the alternative platforms are just not the same.
Yeah, I think we have to strike and simply not interview with these people who malign. And Black Lives Matter, you know, that's the thing I admire, Anne, about the Democratic Party. They sacked the country, major cities, in 2020. Mm. But yet no one of their ranks dare speak about anything but legitimate protest. Protest is the voice of the disenfranchised or something when they commandeer MLK's words. You know, this is peaceful, this is justified, this is social justice. But our side is unable to stand up for the right to assemble. Maybe they don't agree with the voices expressed on the right, but our side just doesn't measure up to the force of the Democratic Party in standing up for what one would call the military arm of the Democratic Party.
I think it is what you were saying. They don't have the backbone. They don't, I guess they want respectability because of the media, who controls the media is more left-leaning, but that was one of the most disappointing things is that the Republicans were even just as quick or quicker to throw the rally goers under the bus and assume that they were evil, assume they were at fault, and to not stand up for their freedom of speech. And that was the worst thing. It used to be, you know, sacrosanct that speech, it doesn't matter how much you dislike the person speaking, but freedom of speech is so important. And they weren't willing to go out and say that. And there was and I have a chapter about this, a huge purge from the internet of anyone that had to do with the rally or even their, you know, any, you know, adjacent to those people. And as this, the censorship started to get rolling, it eventually reached President Trump. And it could have been stopped if they had the spine to say, free speech is important. We don't know. We don't care whether you like these people or not.
And speak to Trump's response, the disappointment of it all. Yeah.
Well, you know, he is the one person who I think at least he put out some truths that other people hadn't heard, that, you know, the the rally goers were the ones with the permit, that there were a lot of militant and bad, dangerous people on the left-wing side. They weren't all, you know, just wholesome, loving, anti-racist people. They were bad people among those counter-protesters. And he said that, and he pointed out that there was likely to continue from Confederate to statues to founding fathers, and he was correct about that. So, you know, I think of all the public figures, he's the only one who even made any attempt to be even-handed.
Yeah, even though he was demonized for that, as I recall at the time. And that is the problem, I think, and it's something, Anne, that Alana and I regularly talk about. It is the failure of those on the political right to assert themselves and not be framed in the language of our enemies, you know. I can only imagine how the people at the rally felt when they saw the weak-kneed, limp-wristed response from those that they may have seen thought were political associates, if not allies. So that must have been, you know, as Alana says, that must have been a huge disappointment.
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, it's appalling. It was really, it's just horrifying when you see, even though you know that the media lies or gets things wrong, you to be a part of something and then see it wildly misrepresented, aggressively, wildly misrepresented everywhere. I mean, it's just this tsunami that's rolling over everything, and it's a lie, and you feel very helpless. And it was really a horrible, horrifying feeling.
What do you think about this idea? Our side, Trump had the right instincts. He threw out, he said, I want to wait, give me time for the facts. But he did not have spokespeople who were capable of getting up on the podium and saying, look, the ACLU, was it in Chicago that they stood up for Nazis walking down a Jewish district or whatever, but they stood up. Now the ACLU is nothing. It's a shadow. It's not even a shadow. It's a disgrace. But there was no ability on our side and on Trump's, the spokesman's of Trump, to articulate principles. You don't even have to agree with the rally goers or with the Unite the Right forces. All you have to say is there was a permit, that we have a Bill of Rights, the right to assemble and speak. All you have to, they are incapable of even doing that. And I doff my head off to the Democrats for being able to articulate their nihilistic, disgusting principles. I mean, detritus of humanity. I mean, that's what they are. But our people, we didn't even have a spokesperson up there speaking about principles. That's all. This is a country of freedom. Mm-hmm. What do you say? Yeah. What do you say? How do we move towards speaking about argument and principles?
I don't know. And I think that a big problem is that people that are on the right really don't have a big platform. You know, as I noted, people got, you know, deplatformed from all the major social media sites. The rally organizer couldn't even get on Fox News, couldn't get any news to talk to him to tell his side of the story. Was, you know, that they really, I don't know how you get the message out when you don't have a means of communicating, a mass communication that isn't controlled by the opposition.
Yeah, it's difficult, but I think one way that you can do it, Anne, is the way that you have done it, insofar as you've catalogued it, you've detailed it. It's there; people can read about it. The actual facts, not the biased, rotten media's salacious fantasy about what actually happened. So I think you've done a great service to people who actually care about the right to to demonstrate and to have free speech, fundamental right. And that's why, folks, Charlottesville Untold, inside Unite the Right, is such a critical raid. There it is, folks.
Please send it to Tucker Carlson. I hope you have.
I don't know. We can try.
You never know. He's being very courageous. He really is.
There are some brave souls, and as I said, you've done a great service in doing it. So listen,
Anna,
thank you very much for coming on the stream. Real pleasure to meet you for the first time, hopefully not the last, and we will speak with you soon. So that's it.
Thank you.
Thanks for now, and
thank you.
Catch up soon. Bye now. Bye, Anne. Right, Alana. And so we move on. This juggernaut that is Hard Truth. It never stops. So
yes, we have an interesting segment. I would call it very controversially "Hands Off My Holocaust."
Yeah,
take it away, David.
Yeah, okay. So if we can bring up, if our producer can bring up this, a couple of really interesting stories, we really need to talk about these. Again, hard truths. It's about so. And these ones, excuse me, Alana, that to be fair, you brought to my attention. A Dutch politician sued over comments comparing COVID restrictions to the Holocaust. But I'm not actually sure that he necessarily did that. If we read into the detail, this is in The Hague, where I think he basically said that the restrictions that they've got going on over in the Netherlands are in a way analogous to what the unvaccinated are being treated like the Jews were in the 1930s. Roughly,
David,
that.
Just to remind you, a week or two back, I likened the unvaccinated to those who were forced to adorn the yellow star of David. And of course, I'm Jewish. I know the history of the final solution. My family tree has lost branches in the Holocaust, and I said that 2 weeks ago. It is hyperbolic. We say things, but this whole coming down on this gentleman, and he's going to be made to pay fines. The Jewish organization involved is coming down hard on him, threatening to sue. I don't know. Don't they have freedom of speech in the Netherlands?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. Some of the I'm not that sure. I mean, as you say, he's being fined €25,000, which is what $28,000 a day if he fails to comply by taking down his postings. I mean, that's extraordinarily censorious, isn't it?
It's unjust, and it really feeds into some very unpleasant stereotypes on held about these sort of pressure groups who move against freedom of speech, the right to express you, to be hyperbolic. I said that. Did I mean that being a child of the Holocaust, having been forced before being herded into ghettos and moved on to concentration camps, did I mean that the unvaccinated are in the same position as the Jews who initially were forced to wear the Star of David just to point to stigmatize them? Of course not. I was being hyperbolic. That's all. There's no disrespect intended, but this fight over legacy by people, some of them are survivors, to be fair, but often by people who just make hay. And I just want to say, because my background is just so how would one say unusual? I remember in South Africa, a young man who went to school with me in Israel, and I grew up in Israel, came to visit me with his father, who was a survivor of the Holocaust. And in Israel, it was a very important theme. You know, at school, we'd have survivors come and speak to us so that there was historic memory. And I grew up, obviously, being your age, we knew very many younger survivors, right? I said to this gentleman, I'm married to someone who isn't Jewish. And he said to me, Medela, he said, young lady, as long as you're happy and that's a good person. It is my feeling that most people who lived through such terrible tragedy in history would just not act like these activists, you know. And they are disgraced. They frankly are a disgrace. And David, one more thing. You being a European, well, an Englishman, Irishman. You began with the European saga. What would happen here as well?
So if we bring up, this talks to the same point, really. So we can bring up, and I think we have it ready to go, another story which is sitting there. Yeah. So Alana, talk us through this one here.
Well, she was lucky that the news cycle moved so fast, because Lara Logan also came under what she likened Fauci. She said people were calling her in or writing her and telling her that people mentioned Mangala, the doctor of death who performed experiments chiefly with Jewish twins. that they were liking Fauci to that. Now, that's hyperbole. People are allowed hyperbole. Lara Logan is not the most sophisticated, refined speaker or thinker. I wouldn't call her a thinker. She should go back to maybe reporting. But people came, again, the whole Jewish interest came down very hard on her. What do you think about
Alana, the thing is, you and I, we do see the world through very similar prisms, I think. And again, I was at a rally a couple of weeks back in Belfast in protest of the bringing in of papers, please, you know, COVID passports, which becomes legal here on the 13th of December. And there was loads of people walking around with yellow stars on them. And all those people were trying to do, that they weren't directly comparing themselves to what obviously would happen during, you know, in the 1930s and 40s. It was an outward and visible way of expressing their alarm, if you like, their terror, their how afraid they were of what lay in store. And so is it hyperbolic? Yeah, possibly. But I've said all of the things. I've referenced Fauci and Mengele happily and will happily continue to do this. I'm not saying he's exactly the same.
And I want to say to you, David, actually it's a legitimate form of argument, reductio ad absurdum. Yes. We often drive a point to absurdity, and this is exactly a good example, to make our point. It's a form of argument, logic, speech. So what we are being the left is inflicting upon us, and maybe not even the left. A lot of people on the right are embarrassed when such things happen and apologize. The right spends its days on its knees. This is just, has always been a way of human speech. You drive home a point with a reductio ad absurdum. You make an absurd point to make an analogy clearer to some obtuse folks. That's all.
That is exactly the point. Yeah. But by contrast, Alana, the left can call us whatever they want. We're all Nazis, white supremacists. That's fine. That's reasonable argument, isn't it? And then when we do which we should do, and we should give them back 10 times harder than they give to us. Well, they all have to lie down in a dark room because their pronouns have been challenged. But you know, I mean, language is so important. You totally understand that. You spent your life, you know, using language as it should be used, and I've tried to do that as well. And so when I see all these things, like those stories you've talked about, you know, it's kind of a bit pathetic that some people have to go after the likes of Logan or the likes of the Dutch guy. There's much better targets to go after, in my opinion, and they're the ones that are being missed. But maybe that's because these are easy targets, Alana.
They're easy targets. They're good people, essentially. You know, this Dutch politician is a nationalist. He loves Holland. He wouldn't hurt a fly except those vermin who hurt his country. But, you know, these are good people. These are decent people. Whereas the left, I'm not sure that there aren't a few decent people left, but predominantly how would Bismarck call it? A putsch. It's an overthrowing of everything, bourgeoisie, everything, middle class, decent, the inversion of values. What is good is now bad. What is bad is good. Yeah. And so the left wants to destroy, and we want to get along and air all opinion.
Exactly. Yeah. No,
We need to change.
Oh, we do. We absolutely do. And time is running out, Alana. The clock is ticking. But it's not just that clock's ticking, because our clock's ticking as well. But we do have time, Alana. We do have time for two last things. I'm going to surprise you at the end, actually. But we've got one final official story to talk about, which, if we bring it up now, which again is an interest. So this is, this relates to the former Ethan Crumbly neighbour. We called in the Children's Protective Services, apparently, on this is, by the way, relates to the Michigan school shooter, the young guy who he shot, was a 15-year-old, but he shot, was it four or five kids? Was that the, I think we've got the details here.
Yeah.
But yeah,
go ahead, David. We might disagree on this one. Go ahead. It's an interesting case.
Okay, Alana. Let's do this. Let's start with you. So essentially, this story is simply saying that there were signs that there was something, behavioral issues, blah de blah de blah. What it hadn't been acted on. Is that the story? What's the point in this?
Yes, there were behavioral issues. There was more than that. The school was remiss, but I watched a segment with Laura Ingram, and she does have this demented grin. She might be discussing the most dire issues, mm-hmm. and there'll always be this, as if it's really tongue-in-cheek, almost a whimsical point, you know. We are fighting over these very, very existential issues, and you have this demented grin. But anyhow, she brought in a defense attorney who was defending the position of these parents and saying they were being overcharged. Now, that might be true. They might be overcharged, David. But conservatives here, and she did not challenge the narrative, the storyline. I will not repeat that cliche narrative. Laura Ingram did not challenge anything, of course, because the whole point was not to do journalism. But it might be that the parents are being overcharged, but there certainly was ample evidence that this child was, they like to say disturbed, reaching out for help. I just say pure evil. I don't like diseasing behavior, but he was just on the right. There was so much warning. And so to me, conservatives really have to stick with one story. Either the parent is the main focus in the child's life, or the state is and the parent is not guilty. I think there is culpability, especially when you purchase a gun for a child. I think he's underage even. And all you do is tweet him benignly and benevolently, please don't do it. So that's my position. I think there is culpability.
I regret to inform you that we agree in this one.
You're
absolutely right. It's first principles. The parents are responsible for their underage child. End of story. So there is culpability, and I mean, you know, whilst he looks in this image here, he looks a tad evil, but maybe it's just the photographs, because if you look at the parents, they don't look exactly people I'd have at a dinner party. It has to be said either. But parents are responsible for their children. That's it. End off.
And look, there's no doubt the school bears responsibility. They let him in. They had a little convention with the parents, and this tolerance does extend to even issues that the left regards as having warranted immediate and firm action. They let him stay at school. He was searching online ammunition at school, and they should have expelled him, no doubt. There is culpability on both, but I don't like our side is On this issue, we could sort of have some sort of middle ground. There is culpability. You know, you lock away your firearms. I have my, I'm not going to show it. I have mine besides my, that I have mine always. You're not allowed to brandish. Always. I have, but I don't have children in the home. And I certainly sleep with my firearm. I find that an attractive proposition. But parents, it's a different matter.
Exactly. No, we agree on that one. Okay, before we wrap the show up, I just wanted to bring you up to date with the development in the UK in the past few hours as we record this, Alana. And that is that the UK government has announced the return of mandatory masks everywhere. And from a date later this month, COVID passports, if you want to go into large scale events, anything with more than 4,000 people, you got to have your pass, you got to show your papers. And this appalls me. It's caused a furious reaction in England as we speak, with a lot of people who have gone along and complied, regretting that. So I just wondered your initial reaction to the UK following...
I'll defer to you. I know you have more fume and fury in you than I have. I believe that your prime minister, Conservative of all things, gave a very unfortunate speech where he fulminated, he stumbled, he couldn't even articulate any principled position, but he's becoming very unpopular, isn't he?
Massively. The opinion, he is more unpopular than certainly than COVID and possibly other forms of disease as well. But one thing I should say before we go, we're just going to go now, but for those watching this in the UK, and for those who, like myself, and I know this is a point of difference between Alana and myself, I don't wear masks, and I'm never wearing a mask, end of. But if Alana, we're just going to a little commercial plug here. If we just bring up on screen for my UK viewers, English in particular, hey, if you want to wear a little badge that says, which states the law, and Alana, I'm very keen on the law, I am face mask exempt because the law says I do not need to wear a face mask unless I want to wear a face mask. These can be purchased over on Alt News Media, one of my other platforms. There will be a link below. Remove that from the screen, please. That's a plug over. Bring Alana back in. I'd rather look at her face than her badge. But actually, it is a point, you know, one can be lawful and nonetheless resist subservience to the bullying state. That's maybe my broader point, Alana.
Yes.
You know, and
so. And with that, we will bid our faithful viewers, hopefully, and growing. Goodbye until next week.
Yes,
farewell.
Yes, indeed. Adios. Yeah, thank you very much for being with us, folks. Remember to hit the Rumble button, hit the like button, subscribe. Make sure you follow us so you get these hard truths on a weekly basis served up by Alana and myself. Thank you all very much. And look forward to speaking to you next week. Bye, everybody.